You're listening to It's About Time. I'm Deb Krumholtz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dix McComas. We're speaking today with Judith Levine. Judith is the author of many articles for national magazines, as well as four books, including Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex, and My Enemy, My Love, Women, Masculinity, and the Dilemmas of Gender. She has now written a book, Not Buying It, about her experience of withdrawing from the marketplace and not buying anything for a year. Welcome to the show, Judith. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what I'd like to start with is, for those who haven't read your book, for us to hear a little about the premise and what motivated you to write it.
Not Buying It is the journal of the year 2004, during which I and my partner Paul bought nothing but necessities. Now we can talk a little later about what necessities are, but what I decided to do was to try to remove myself as much as possible from the marketplace, not only of things, but also of services and experiences, to see what my relationship is to the marketplace, and then to think about and learn about our personal relationships and therefore our public and social relations to the great big global problem of overconsumption. So there were two motivations. One was personal. I started thinking about it around Christmas time when I had managed to spend $1,001, even though I'm Jewish and I don't really care about Christmas. And also I was thinking about all of these new electronic gizmos and plastic toys and sweaters that nobody wanted, and what was going to happen to them 6 months down the road. They would probably end up in a landfill where they would last until the end of time.
It's so interesting because even thinking about that time of year, and I also am Jewish and I also get carried away, a lot of it is pressure from other people and from outside sources. Like, I'll say, I'm not going to buy anything this year, and then other people buy me things, and I feel I'm supposed to reciprocate. So, yeah, talk about a little about what it was like to not be on the other end of things, to not be a giver for that year, to be more of a recipient.
Well, that's a very big issue about our relationship to purchasing. As you're suggesting, gifts come along with many social codes, even if they're not spoken or written down. We have many rules that apply to gift giving and gift getting, the primary one of which is, if somebody gives you something, you should give them something back. And it should be more or less the equivalent in effort or monetary value or importance to you, so that if someone gives you a set of luggage, you're not allowed to give them back a bar of soap. And in our year of not shopping, we found our friends to be incorrigibly generous. One friend said, you know, when somebody stops shopping, it's as if a vacuum forms and you feel you have to rush in and fill it. People felt a little sorry for us. Sometimes they felt kind of bored being with us. So if they wanted to go to a movie, they felt because of our rules, they would have to pay for us to go to the movies. And we kept on saying, no, please don't give us stuff. We're trying to figure out what it's like to not be doing any of this buying. And yet, as you said, you know, our social relationships, our family relationships, our identities, our culture, our relationship to the culture, even I would say our participation in politics is enabled and mediated through the purchase of things and experiences.
Judith, I would like to know, you wrote the book. If you could tell us a little bit about Paul's participation in all this, how the idea came. Did you jointly come up with this idea, or did you have to sell it to him?
I came up with the idea
because
I was going to be the writer, and he was thrilled. Paul is a guy who comes from a very poor family in Vermont. It's a family, like many Vermonters, that did everything itself. He knows how to fix cars and do plumbing and garden, and there's nothing that Paul doesn't know how to fix. And he's just not a guy who goes out and buys stuff. You have to drag him out of the house to get a new shirt or a pair of socks. So he was really happy to do it. And furthermore, it was fun for us to have a project to do together. And so far from it being the source of lots of conflict, although I can talk a little bit about the conflicts we did have, it tended to be an experience that brought us together.
I'm curious, was this, when you came up with the idea, was it something, overconsumption, was it something you two had talked about for years and then this something occurred and you just thought, let's do this this 1 year without? In other words, did the idea come to him as a complete surprise?
No, I don't think it did. Paul and I are not big consumers, although when you survey people, everyone thinks they're not big consumers. Everyone thinks they don't make enough money to support a decent lifestyle, and everyone thinks that everybody else is materialistic, but they themselves are not materialistic.
Right, right.
So we're just like everyone else. We're not materialistic.
Right.
We don't buy a lot of stuff. But, you know, we buy our $4 bottle of organic milk, and, you know, we have our consumer things that we buy. I just went yesterday and bought a $30 bicycle saddle. So,
wow.
You know,
uh-huh.
I have my things that I buy, too. But we both have been watching over the last few years, and probably the last 10 to 20 years, at the ways in which our culture and our political discourse has more and more constructed us as consumers. That is, you know, you're no longer a driver when you go to the Motor Vehicles Bureau. Now you're a consumer. When you go to college, you're no longer a university student. Now you're a consumer. You're no longer a patient at the hospital. You're a consumer of health services. And so we are more and more thinking of ourselves as people who relate to the world by giving it money and then deciding whether we like what we get or not. And if we don't like it, we just want our money back. And we think about our government that way, too. You know, you don't want to pay taxes because you don't like the services you're getting, as if the government were a company. Both of us are very concerned at the effect this has on our collective sense of responsibility and willingness to invest in the public good. Because the government's not something that we buy. It's something that we own already. I mean, you don't say, your kids are bad, I'm not going to feed them. You know, you recognize that you have responsibility for them. And if something's going wrong, you have responsibility to help them or if you want to discipline them. But you don't withdraw your money from supporting them.
What really appealed to me about the way you approached this was that I think you set it up in a way that helped you be successful because you saw it as a challenge rather than you were going to deprive yourself. And to me, that makes it more exciting if I feel like it's a game or a challenge. But I wonder, did you feel deprived? I assume you did a bit during that year.
Yes, I felt deprived sometimes. I felt deprived in particular of a ready access to the culture. I love to go to the movies, I like to read new books, I like to go to the theater, and furthermore, my identity is tied to those experiences. I think of myself as someone in the know, and I need that kind of stimulation to have an intellectual life. And also, it lubricates my social life. I talk to my friends about those things. And so I often felt lonely and kind of stupid not being part of this, you know, endless flow of new stuff going by. I didn't tend to miss things very much, partly because, and I think everyone, probably your listeners have had this experience, if you just look around your house, you just have so much already. We didn't run out of soap until the end of the year. So I didn't have a longing for things, but I sure did have a longing for purchased experiences.
Could you say more and go into specifics about how you drew the line between luxuries and necessities and what you could and couldn't buy?
That was an ongoing discussion. Probably 90% of everything that everyone in the West buys falls more into the category of luxury than need. After all, we could all, you know, live under tarps and eat bowls of rice, but we don't. So we argued some about it. We decided we were not going to buy any new CDs or books or gifts or clothes. We weren't going to go to restaurants. We weren't going to go to the theater. We could borrow those things from the library, but we weren't going to spend any money on them. If we got sick, I suppose we would have gone to the doctor. But also, of course, we have many remedies in our house, and we didn't have to go out and buy any more cough syrup. And, for instance, Paul, being Italian, decided that wine is a necessity. He said to me, "It's like milk." I looked at him, and
I don't get
then
that.
He said, "It's like water."
Right.
So I didn't think it was a necessity. I thought it was a luxury. And the way he solved this problem was he found a couple of Italian friends who'd been making wine, and he joined in with them and made wine too. And it was very good wine, and it turned out to be a lot of fun for him to do. But I think that just goes to show that everybody has their so-called necessities. You or I might say, well, books are a necessity. Yes, they might be. You could live without them. But, well, then how do you serve that necessity? You might go to the library and borrow books. So we went around and around about it. We bought insulin for our diabetic cat. It was pointed out to me that having a diabetic cat in the first place might be considered a luxury.
Oh, boy, everyone had their opinions.
We're already rather attached to our cat. Yeah, <so. laughs>
Did you draw lines in terms of, like, premium grades of things, like coffee or
no,
we
didn't
foods,
buy
organic
the cheapest
foods?
Or we didn't buy the cheapest or the simplest in any category of thing that we had already deemed to be a necessity. So we did buy good organic coffee. We do buy organic foods. We didn't buy, you know, we're just as cost conscious as other people. And so if we can buy the generic insulin, we'll buy it instead of the brand name insulin. But no, we weren't intending to be skinflints mm-hmm. or to cut down on our expenditures. Nevertheless, we did. And I ended up saving about $8,000 over the year.
You know, just personally, after having read the book, it did shift for me when I shop now, my thinking about necessities. I mean, it was like there was no way around that. Once you read your book, you're going to think differently. And it made me question. I'd be in, you know, CVS drugstore. Do I need this? Do I? And it has helped me in rethinking what I buy. Has it had that kind of effect as after the year ended? Do you continue to think in terms of necessity, not necessity?
I do. I think in two ways. I certainly think about the impulse buy. But, you know, the other way I think more about my purchases is to think about the whole life story of this product, not just at what economists call the point of purchase, that is when you hand over your credit card and get the thing across the table. So where was this thing made? Who made it? What kind of wages was she earning? How much fuel went into it? How much fuel did it take to get it there from there to here where I'm buying it? And after I tire of it, what's going to happen to it? Where is it going to go? Is it biodegradable? How long is it going to last? Is it going to last forever? So you can think about these things in a much bigger way, and that your relationship to them is only one little point, one rung on this ladder.
Judith, could you tell us, I don't know, two or three things that maybe after your experiment you would never buy, given all the factors you just mentioned, things that maybe you would have bought innocently before but you wouldn't buy now?
That's a good question.
I mean, other than the little fan.
Well, I would say that all of those kinds of little things, there are probably 16 billion at CVS, as you were saying before.
Right, right.
You know, but having said that, last year a friend of ours helped Paul and me, or a couple of years ago, training for a ski marathon. And so after the marathon, I was in the drugstore and I saw this cute little plastic cow with little wiggly feet, and I brought it home and we made skis for the cow from an old yogurt container mm-hmm. and gave them to Linda as a present. And she said now whenever she does a ski race, she brings the cow with her. So this is in Vermont, you know, we have cows here. So, you know, so there are so many really wonderful, delicious, exciting things for us to buy that, you know, going back to the question about deprivation, it's true that it's much more fun to do a project when you think of it as a challenge. But I do think that we can get off on being righteous and depriving ourselves more than the next guy who's greedy and materialistic. And so that's why my book has in it a critique of some of the motivations of the Simple Living Movement, that this is often about self-righteousness, guilt, and a kind of sanctimony, and a sacrifice of pleasures. I think there are many pleasures out there that don't need to be bought, and yet capitalism, cultures, give us many pleasures that can be bought. So I don't know if there's any category of thing that I would rule out absolutely that I wouldn't buy.
You know, I wanted to ask you how you and Paul handled, say, birthday parties or occasions where a gift was almost like a ticket in.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had lots of those little things, and what we'd do would be generally make a pie or something and bring it. And people always appreciate that way more than some little thing you went and picked up. But we did have a very big gift to get, and that was my niece graduated college. And, of course, we wanted to give her something big to commemorate this big achievement. So we thought a lot about it, and first I thought we would make her, two or three dozen silk roses. And we tried to get a craft book out of the library. All the craft books had been stolen from the library. So there's a sort of little story through the book of looking for this Silk Rose book at the library. Finally, what we decided was we would give her something that we already had that I really loved. And this was a silver necklace that my mother had bought just after the war. And she had worn for a long time, and then she had given me, and then I had worn it. And so we took it out and polished it up and fixed the clasp, and I sewed a little sack for it, and Paul made a little box to put the sack in, and we gave that to Sarah. And it looked really beautiful on Sarah, and she really loved it, and she said, now I can always have something of Grandma and Judy with me. So it was so much more meaningful a gift than anything we would have bought, and it really also made us think a lot about Sarah and who she is and what she values. And one of the things she really values is her family.
Speaking of family, could I ask you, you mentioned earlier that Paul came from a rural Vermont family, and you're from New York.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up, I would assume, in a much more kind of, on the streets of New York, where consuming is the thing that one does. Was the year harder for you in ways that are hard for you in ways that it just wasn't for Paul?
Yes. My parents were both sort of countercultural types in a way, and that they weren't big consumers either. Like, I look at my mother, who's now 86 years old, and she has almost no stuff. So they didn't care a lot about things. But you're right. Urban life is a lot about purchasing. Even little experiences, like you want to have a cup of coffee, you want to sit someplace and be publicly private. In the country, you might go sit under a tree or take a walk on the road. In New York, you go and get yourself a cup of coffee in a cafe, and that costs you $2 or $3 or $5. And there's almost nothing you can do in the city that doesn't cost some money. You at least have to put $2 in to, you know, get on the subway to go to some sort of free event. And so I felt more isolated in the city than I did in the country, because so much of the things that you do socially and the things that are fun in the country are free things. But also, there's a great deal in the city that can be done for free. We would go on Friday nights to the museums when they're free. We would bring a little picnic supper and eat it in the cafeteria of the museum. Nobody seemed to care that we were carrying our own bag of food. We would go to the park. We would go to the street fairs and just walk around. And even though you're not buying anything at the street fair, it's just like going to a museum. You know, you don't have to buy the Picasso. You can go and visit it. And so we began to look at things in the city more as one would look at an exhibition in a museum.
I think the thing that I would be most afraid of is the lack of connection. And, you know, you talk about, I liked how you said consumption is an exercise in hope for more beauty, more happiness, more status. And I would also add more connection because, you know, like you said, we go out to eat so we can connect with people. Has your connections with people been different from 2004 and then after that?
It's funny, you know, You know, it's true that since the beginning of civilization, people would come to the marketplace maybe to buy and sell things, and then they'd sit under a tree and buy a cup of tea for a nickel and talk to their friends and smoke a pipe. And so getting together not just individuals but cultures and countries and trading and assimilating and exchanging ideas, all of that has been done through the exchange of things. During our year, we invited people to our house a lot for dinner. That was one of the things we did. Or we would take a walk with people, or we would make a picnic and go to a park together. Or we would discover some place new in the city and invite somebody along to go walk and look at it with us. And so the experiences that we had socially were much more about talking to friends. It really made me appreciate a lot the intimacy of what you can do when you're not both focusing outward at something, but you're focusing on one another.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about how your friends, your circle of friends, responded or reacted to your project?
They responded variously. I say in the book that some of them admired us and, you know, made T-shirts, Judith and Paul, live like them. But then there were those who I said, you know, regarded us with an attitude that there's probably a German word for, which is admiration
right.
for a project you're glad someone else is doing so you don't have to.
Right, right.
Some of them were kind of appalled by it. You know, my God, go are you without shopping, you crazy? I think many of our friends share the values that we do and are worried about overconsumption and also don't have that much money, as we don't. So they pretty much admired us, and a lot of them said, you know, I was on the street, and I saw this table, and there were all these earrings, and I would usually buy a pair, but I thought, I don't really need this. I'm going to be like Judith and not buy it. So I've been accused by some business writers that, you know, I'm going to single-handedly bring down the capitalist system.
Yeah, right. You know, I know that, I don't remember, I think you were quoting someone else when you said in your book that boredom is the threshold to great deeds, and I wonder if you found that to be true, or is boredom just boredom?
What I said in the book is sometimes boredom's not even the threshold to deeds. I would just sit there sometimes, you know, gazing at my cat. I found that I was bored more than I thought I would be, and that I receive a certain amount of chagrin. I don't think of myself as somebody who gets bored, and a lot of the simple living gurus will promise you that once you stop buying stuff, you're going to find deep wells of inner resources and your authentic self. Well, you know, sometimes you gaze down into that resource, into that recess of yourself, and it's just one big empty well. We really depend a lot on the stuff and the experiences we buy to have thoughts, to have feelings. You know, you read books, it makes you think about your culture, it makes you think about yourself, about relationships, about politics. And so boredom is a hard thing to contend with, and we often solve boredom by buying something.
Judith, could you, this may be too specific, but I'm wondering, could you tell us a time of day, say, that was really hardest, say in the afternoon when you would have gone and gotten coffee, or in the evening when you would have taken in a movie or dinner? What, I mean, was there a particular time of day that just was, could be excruciating since you couldn't shop?
I would say that sort of early evening time after I've finished working and, you know, might go out. What I often do in the city is I'll go out and take a bike ride or take a walk, but you often take a bike ride or a walk with a little destination. I'm going to go buy X. You know, you need to go to the drugstore and pick up something. And it gives a shape to your bike ride or to your walk. And so I often had a sense of shapelessness in my life. Mm. And consuming gives you, as not only hope, but it organizes your time. And in your show, I'm sure people talk a lot about once they stop shopping that they suddenly have great, you know, vast reaches of time that they may appreciate having, but also then you have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So would you still go out on your bike and stare at stores and lament that you couldn't go in? Or
I said that the French word for for window shopping is faire la lèche vitrine, which means licking shop windows. I found that I looked less. I looked, as the year went by, I didn't look in shop windows very much. When the catalogs came, I would just throw them away. I actually got less and less interested. And the funny thing is, like a lot of people, before that year, I would get the catalogs and look at them very raptly and then usually not buy anything. But I even stopped kind of looking at them to not buy, but just to enjoy them. So there was a way that as the year went by, I really did extricate myself from the concerns of the shopper.
Did you find that this whole bombardment of ads, was that even more intrusive at this time?
I began to look at them much more as an anthropologist or as a social critic. They got weirder to me when I had nothing whatsoever to do with judging the product itself. I was much more able to look at the manipulations of them and also to look at them as a Martian might, like, what the heck is being sold here? And I would say that just about everything that's advertised is not necessary.
It's a great lesson to teach people. I was just talking about teaching my daughter that, like, if you see an ad for it, you don't need it. You know, they don't advertise.
Although it's funny, you know, now they're starting to advertise. You can buy a brand name replacement hip.
Oh, my gosh.
Another thing we were talking about before we spoke with you is this feeling of that money equals autonomy and feeling like a grown-up and powerful, and not having or not spending may put us in that position of feeling lesser than. Is that an experience that you went through?
One day I was going skiing. Now, one thing we did buy before the year began was our cross-country ski passes, which are about $70 for the year because we're very avid skiers. So I was going up to the ski place, and I realized that I had forgotten my wax for my skis, and you can't ski if you don't have wax on the bottom of your skis. So I was driving up, beautiful day, perfect day for skiing, and the whole time I was fretting, what am I going to do? Am I going to ask for this? Am I going to just turn around? I was ready to turn around and not go skiing. If I went back, it was going to be too late. It would get dark. I wouldn't be able to make it up in time. So finally I get up there. I go into the hut. I say to the young man who works there, could I borrow a couple of swipes of blue wax? And he says, borrow? You can have it. No, this is, you know, a penny's worth of wax, if that. Mm-hmm. But what I recognized was that when you can use your credit card or you can buy things, you can buy your way out of predicaments. And that is what grown-ups do. Grown-ups have autonomy. Grown-ups have the means to take care of themselves. And that often translates into money. So when you have to ask for help, you make yourself vulnerable and you make yourself infantile. Kids are the people in the world who don't have money. Adults are the ones who have money. And that makes all of the difference. It gives you power. It gives you autonomy. It gives you the ability to create yourself and to create your world and to insulate yourself from discomfort. You know, it starts to rain. You can go in and buy an umbrella. All of these things are done with money. And so I found myself much more vulnerable. But the good part of it was I saw that when you ask people for help, generally they like to give it.
Well, that's a great way to end. I really appreciate you taking your time to talk with us today,
Thank you, Judith.
Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us. We always welcome your comments and story ideas. Just email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and time urgency. Find them at timeday.org. Join us every week for It's About Time on Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock, right here on WMUA 91.1 FM.